During the anniversary of D-Day that comes up later this week, the names of General Eisenhower and President Roosevelt will be mentioned quite a bit. But what about William Knudsen, who quit his job running General Motors to help mobilize the country's industrial base for war? Never heard of William Knudsen? Well, Arthur Herman tells his story and that of other business leaders who contributed to the war effort in his latest book, Freedom's Forge, How American Business Produced Victory in World War II. It's published by Random House. I'm very pleased it has brought Dr. Herman to our show today. Dr. Herman is a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
You say that President Roosevelt procrastinated in preparing the country for war.
I think that's sort of the consensus among historians. The big question is why and what the consequences were. And what I show in this book...
Well, wasn't there an awful strong feeling of American isolationism at the time?
Well, that was part of it. That was a huge part of it. But also, I think what you have to realize is that Roosevelt sensed as early as 1939 that probably war was going to come pretty close to American shores. That the war in Europe was going to have a spillover effect, and that if the other Western democracies, particularly Britain, fell to the Nazis, that we would be in a situation where we would have a Nazi-dominated sea power able to basically control sea lanes and direct us forth. So he begins the process himself in 1939, but things really kick into gear in May of 1940 when France is on the verge of collapse from the Blitzkrieg. Britain is cut off at Dunkirk. It may well fall. And he suddenly realizes that he has, number one, a military which is 18th in the world. The army is. Holland has a bigger army than we did at that point. And he has an industrial base which is totally unprepared for this process, and he has to find a solution.
And Holland's army didn't help it much against
No, it certainly didn't. And it wasn't just the size of the army. It was preparation for this new type of warfare, the new mass mechanized air power kind of war that was coming.
So why did he choose Bill Knudsen, a Republican and the president of General Motors, to lead the effort?
Well, now, that's an interesting story, and it really is the kickoff for the book because – Roosevelt, when he realizes his guts tell him something really terrible is going to come and he's got to get the country ready for it, he calls Bernard Baruch. And Bernard Baruch, who was a Democrat fundraiser and sort of his Wall Street connection. And Baruch says, the person you've got to call is Bill Knudsen. He knows more about industrial production than anybody else in the country. He is a legend in Detroit, in many ways even more respected than Henry Ford, as a man who understands how mass production really works and how to mobilize these kinds of forces that you're going to need if we're going to get this country ready for modern war.
Wouldn't Henry Ford have been a bad choice simply because he had already expressed certain sympathies for Hitler?
He had, and he was mired in the isolationism that was also very much the current in Congress. This was the other problem Roosevelt was going to face, as I explain in the book. So there's no money forthcoming. There's no authorizations coming from Congress. This is all going to have to be done in a kind of informal way through phone calls and handshakes to get conversion to wartime production underway. And that's what Knudsen was a master of.
Well, Knudsen was a Danish immigrant. How did he work his way up from performing manual labor in a shipyard to leading General Motors?
He was a bicycle man first, Leonard.
So were the Wright brothers.
Really well known. Yeah, it's interesting, too, as was Alfred Sloan, the man who becomes his boss at General Motors. He was a well-known bicycle builder and racer in his native country. He comes over to this country because he figures this is a place where I can really expand my skills. He works in a Buffalo bicycle plant, which is, to his disappointment, is shifting over to making auto parts for Henry Ford. But he organizes the plant force so efficiently that Ford hires him first, brings him out to Highland Park, which becomes the plant that's the center of mass production. And then Knudsen leaves Ford and takes over Chevrolet and brings the same techniques and skills and raises him to an even higher level there.
When Roosevelt approached him, had Denmark already been occupied by Germany?
Let me think about this for a second. Not quite yet. No, it's about to be, as a matter of fact. And his four sisters were there. And it's a kind of frightening thing. He's surrounded by all these isolationists who sort of say, oh, America's never going to go to war again. It's not our business. And this whole time he has four sisters who are basically incommunicado in Nazi-occupied Denmark. It must have concentrated his mind a lot about this issue.
What did Roosevelt offer to pay him?
Roosevelt said, we really can't pay you anything. And Knudsen sort of said, that's okay, don't worry about salary. What he will collect is what all of the other business executives he recruits, which is a dollar a year as federal salary, well, as they go on leave from their own companies, AT&T and Libby Browning Glass and all the other companies that are connected with
it. Well, we don't see CEOs willing to leave their high-paying jobs nowadays to do public service for even a better salary. Has something changed in this country, do you think?
I don't know. I don't know if you really asked them. I mean, I wonder what would have happened if Obama had made a similar phone call to Steve Jobs before he died and said, you know what, the economy is in terrible shape, which, of course, it also was when Roosevelt calls Knudsen. And in the back of everybody's mind is we've got an industrial base which has been caught in a decade of depression. How do we get this revived, not just for wartime, but for economic growth afterwards? What would happen if he had called Jobs or if he'd called Larry Ellison and said, listen, this is what I need. These are the kinds of buttons I need you to help me to push and to get underway. Knudsen, as an immigrant, this is the other factor, too, I think, believed very much that he owed this country everything. He had come here as an immigrant. He had worked his way up. He was deeply proud of the life that he had built for himself, really basically out of nothing. And when his president calls, he feels he can't say no.
So what was the state of the American defense industry when Knudsen arrived in Washington in the spring of 1930?
It was basically nil. There was nothing. There were a few aviation companies that, in addition to their commercial lines, made planes for the Army Air Corps, whenever the Army Air Corps might want it, or for the Navy.
Comparable to what the British had or the Germans had?
Nothing like that. I mean, this was the other miracle of this whole story, as I explain in the book, is that Knudsen, simply by pushing the informal connections and through his persuasive power and the power of his personality, is able to gear up an American industrial base to surpass the Nazis, surpass Soviet Union and Great Britain, who had been mobilized for war for years.
Well, they had to decide on how to get raw materials, what weapons to make, what vehicles to produce. Did anyone know how much of each item would be needed?
No. And this was the other frustration that Knudsen had when he arrived, was not just dealing with sort of the isolationist mentality in Congress, but he also has a War Department and a U.S. Army that really don't know what it is they're going to need. This is an entirely new departure for everybody. And
well, they could look at Germany and say,
they
could
look at Germany and say,
we
need things like that. But what Knudsen realized was that as he talks to people for example, in the aviation companies like Boeing and Lockheed, is that these guys have already thought out these problems. They have on hand, in their drawers, designs for modern weapons that will far surpass what it is the Germans and the Japanese are building. And all they were waiting for was a chance to get that underway, to get the government contracts so they could begin to produce the weapons they knew would be superior and would make the country safe.
My guest is Arthur Herman, whose latest book is Freedom's Forge, published by Random House. What do you mean when you say that Knudsen convinced Roosevelt to keep the war production effort decentralized? You seem to think that was a good thing. Isn't that the beginning of what Eisenhower later warned about, the military-industrial complex?
Yeah, and I think one of the things, and you read this book, is you realize there are certain key advantages to a military-industrial complex, as long as it isn't too complicated, and that is that you use market forces and the kind of private sector energies and incentives as a way to get not only the best production but also the best technologies deployed. There was a big call in that summer of 1940, in the middle of this crisis, big call within Roosevelt's own administration, appoint a war production czar. Let's appoint someone who's going to be able to control all the levers of power we'll declare a national emergency, we'll nationalize whatever industries we need. Let's do it the Soviet way. Let's do it the way the Germans are doing it, the way the British are to a large extent doing with the Minister of Armaments. And Roosevelt resisted that, and he resisted it for two reasons. One is he didn't want to relinquish that power to a single individual who would become, in a sense, co-president, but also because Knudsen said to him, look, if you allow me to mobilize the private sector to use those kinds of energies and incentives that are there built into the way in which companies already operate, give me 18 months, and you'll have more war material than any of the other countries.
And
in the
why
world.
Would it take 18 months? Do they have to start building the things, actually, to the machinery to build?
That's exactly right. And Knudsen had had this experience during World War I. He had been Ford Motor Company's head of wartime production. He knew the pitfalls. And he knew the process of building new plants, putting in the new machine tools. So instead of making refrigerators, now you're going to make machine guns. Or instead of civilian cars and fenders, you're going to make military trucks. That the whole process to get up and actually start getting things off the assembly line in numbers would about 18 months. And he was correct.
And not just for the United States. We were also thinking about supplying Britain.
This was also one of the big headaches he faced, as I explain in the chapters dealing with Lend-Lease. Knudsen really lays the foundations for Lend-Lease by saying we can have the industrial capacity. Once we start conversion to wartime production, we can begin to supply our allies too. And there also, Knudsen turned out to be a prophet.
Well, not everybody jumped in. Henry Ford refused when Knudsen offered him a contract to make engines for British fighter jets in 1940. Did he ever come around?
That was for the Spitfire. And Ford eventually does when Knudsen goes back to him and says, look, we'll just make it for American aircraft. This is even before the war. And then once war broke out, Ford jumped on the bandwagon. And Ford Motor Company is probably the most spectacular achievement of sort of private industry shifting to wartime production was the big B-24 factory at Willow Run that I talk about in the middle of the book.
And then the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941.
Which is ironic in some ways.
Because did we already have all the weapons we needed?
We were already underway. That's the ironic thing, is that Knudsen's 18 months from June of 1940 to December of 1941 almost comes right to his deadline. And by that date, United States munitions productions, from a standing start, in those 18 months was approaching the rate of Nazi Germany.
And then Hitler fired Knudsen. I mean, Roosevelt.
Yeah, well, what happened was, is with the coming of war, the people who'd been opposed to Knudsen's decentralized kind of capitalist-minded approach sort of said, the situation's too serious now for this kind of, you know, incrementalism. Now we have to get a full war production czar. Knudsen goes out, but what happens from that point on, from 1941 to the end of the war, is that the system he's created has already become so productive that no one really wants to, no one can find a way to put the brakes on.
And one of the heroes also of this book is somebody Knudsen didn't get along with all that well, Henry J. Kaiser.
No, they were, the giants aren't always, geniuses aren't always comfortable in the company of other geniuses. And the two of them, although in many ways alike, both of them outsiders. Kaiser, son of German immigrants, dropped out of school at 13. A frenetic workaholic in the construction business, builds Boulder Dam. And then as war begins to build in the summer of 1940, is looking for government contracts and finally lands one. Knudsen sort of says he can't stand it, but I'll give you this contract, which is for the Liberty ships. And the Liberty ships and Henry Kaiser become synonymous to the whole arsenal of democracy.
Well, then after the war, it's ironic, I think, that General Motors, Knudsen's former company, did an awful lot to cause Kaiser's entry into the automobile business a real problem.
A real problem. Kaiser was convinced that he could do anything after the war. I mean, he'd gone from construction industry to building ships, to building steel, aluminum, magnesium, airplanes, why not cars, that he could bring his skill and his business savvy and drive and energy to the automobile industry. The situation is a little bit more complex than just the hostility of the big three automakers. I think also Kaiser didn't really understand consumer markets and consumer marketing and pricing.
Well, the Henry J would probably be popular today.
And of course, they're great collectors of items today. It was a venture that was, I think, in many ways bound to fail. And unfortunately kind of put the seal on Kaiser's sort of public image, because up until then, most people recognized that he had been a key maker in this arsenal of democracy and in getting America ready for war.
Arthur Herman's book is called Freedom's Forge: How American Business Produced Victory in World War II. It's published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure.